The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present The Orthodox Medievalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of history, a professional writer, and a priest of the Russian Orthodox Church. His web journal can be found at russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
All right, this is me, Rick Adams, and tonight, Friday night, this edition of the program, we're going to have with us for a bit, again, backed by popular demand and my invitation, Matthew Raphael Johnson, Ph.D., former lecturer in international affairs at the University of Nebraska, former professor of history at Mount St. Mary's University, former editor of the Barnes Review, and he's also doing, I believe, a talk show from time to time as well. So he's going to be with us momentarily, and I like to call him by his first name. He says, I have permission, Matt. So that's that's nice to know. Last time we were together, we were spending some time talking about World War II and the betrayal of freedom and the fact of U.S. interventionism in the war and what it resulted in, as per my documentary as well, as you know. Most of you know that. And tonight we're going to get into other areas as well. North Korea, Red China, Russia, Ossetia, all of these questions that are on the table. And, of course, the whole international new world order that we have. The question about what is going on in Honduras, in Latin America, Central America, South America, all over the world, there seems to be nation rising against nation and turmoil right across the entire globe. So I want you, at some point in this hour, to be ready to come online. And if you have a question pertaining to these policies, about anything, Russian Orthodox Church, what has happened in Russia over the years, then by all means, you can do so. And we'll hopefully have Matt Johnson with us tonight for as long as we can, as we'd like to, as often as we can. His website is available also, russjournal.com. And if you pull it up, you'll see some of the headlines. The Russian Orthodox Medievalist. The Orthodox Medievalist now on radio. Cuban government and society deeply Masonic. And there are other issues here today that will come up, I'm sure. The Constantinople Church openly supports the homosexual agenda. Essays on the Western Rite in Orthodoxy. Essays on pre-revolutionary Russia. These are many of the subjects that do come up. So, we will do that in a few moments. We'll welcome Professor Johnson with us. Rick Adams, Radio Avenger, you stay right where you are. And I think we might be ready now to welcome Matt Johnson to the program. Is Matt there?
Hey, Rick, I'm doing okay. We're just having some technical difficulties here. For some reason, my microphone is completely dead.
We always have some problem at the beginning of the show, usually, don't we, huh?
I don't know. You know, technology is supposed to make our lives easier.
Oh, it is. It's easier to complain and rant and rave. But anyway, I'm happy you're here because, as you know, that we always welcome your appearance on the program. Do you have your own radio program, too, now?
Well, I'm on the Voice of Reason Network. I have a program dealing with Russia and Ukraine there, called the Orthodox Medievalist, and they had come to me, and they wanted me to do this after Steve Schenck had interviewed me some months ago. They sent me all my equipment, and the equipment that's only half working now, but we're trying to get our act together, and I'm doing a show every week. It's not done live, but it's really kind of a talk-style format, and it's going really well. I'm getting a lot of, you know, it's a very specialized show, so I have a very much a targeted audience, but you know, I'm getting some good feedback. But of course, I got my practice from you. I mean, you were sort of the Obi-Wan of the radio world for me, and so I learned from the best.
Was my program the first one you went on?
No. You know what? I was just thinking that before. About a decade ago, a little less than that, I was on with a guy from Florida who used to work at the Spotlight.
Right.
You know who I mean? I can't think of him off the top of my head.
I know who you mean. I know who you mean, and I haven't spoken with him or talked to him in about 3.5 years, and I don't recall his name myself right now.
Is it Tom Valentine?
That's him. Yeah, Tom Valentine, right.
Yeah. No, he was a nice enough guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was close to us. We were at the Spotlight, and then when it became the American Free Press, and I'm not sure what happened to him. I haven't spoken to him in ages.
Yeah, I think he was doing pretty well, and he was doing something different, and retired, I think, in Florida. But anyway, he certainly was quite a mainstay of the Spotlight in those days. And you, of course, have, as we said, in introducing you, I mentioned the Barnes Review and. Oh, you have been also an anchor for, a university life as a professor in two institutions, at least that I know of. And the questions always come up about what's going on. In order to know what's going on in the present, I suppose you have to know quite a bit of history, particularly the history of Europe and the history of what's going on in the world today. And I almost don't know where to start, but I referred people to your website, RussJournal.com, and people can see some of the topics that you're dealing with right now in the world as we speak. And I'd like to maybe ask you, as far as some of the other countries are concerned, we hear a lot about North Korea these days, and North Korea firing missiles and having nukes, and then, of course, Iran being a threat to Israel, and we hear so much about Russia. I know Seth here today. How do you sort it all out, Matt? How do you begin to look at the world through that prism?
Well, it's a difficult question. I was just on Freedom House's website today, which is a big establishment neoliberal institution, and they list the 10 least free places on the planet. And I had to chuckle as I'm going through them because all 10 are open opponents of the Israeli state. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking it's awful strange that they all seem to have this in common, even where, you know, they're scattered throughout the globe. Belarus is on there, of course. North Korea is on there. I think Kazakhstan is on there. Burma is on there. And apart from being enemies of Israel, all of these states, mostly relatively obscure ones, that they have listed are also very deeply nationalist in their social orientation. Mm-hmm. I'm of the opinion, and I know that that people like Willis Cardo and others agree with me on this, that, you know, places like China and Burma and even places like Thailand, these places, to the extent that they were ever really socialist states, what they are now is national socialist states.
Mm-hmm.
Even North Korea, despite the eccentricities of the dictator there, it seems to me that North Korea is desperately attempting to maintain some sort of independence in a world that's controlled by a handful of banks and a handful of large countries. And I just can't help, in spite of what we might think about North Korea, politically speaking, I can't help but sympathize with that struggle. And mm-hmm. if having nuclear weapons is the only way that they're going to get respect, then that's what they have to do. If Iraq had nuclear weapons, they would not have been invaded in 1990, 1991. Mm-hmm. So, this is how countries need to get respect and to get some kind of independence. And this Asian nationalist alliance, it seems to be North Korea, China, Burma, India when they feel like it, and to some extent Malaysia, almost creating this a new axis, this new economy based on, you know, regional sovereignty and national sovereignty. And that's why all of a sudden all of these countries are being lumped together as this new Asian axis of evil. And in spite of how different these states are from one another, they at the very least deserve our respect, in spite of what they may have done in the past. What they're doing now is attempting to create a new economic world apart from that of the major banks and the major corporations and the countries that that back them up. And I do think that the riots in Western China, it's not an accident that these riots are taking place in a province that is extremely wealthy in minerals and in oil. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens, I was reading a Russian website just before I came on, that that particular part of China is home to China's nuclear weapons research laboratories, are mostly in remote parts of Western China. So I don't think that's an accident. I think the CIA is deeply involved in that as well. So I think East Asia, certain states in East Asia are really frightening the establishment, and we have to give our respect to that.
Well, now, you have also... You have also written two new books, haven't you?
I get books all over the place. Sometimes I forget about them.
Well, I know on your website you said they're available in your Diapara Press. And,
See, but that's
you
not mine. That's not mine. That belongs to a Spanish group, a Spanish Orthodox group that has put that press together and invited me on. And they're good people. They're very much our people, politically speaking, and they're very solid. I'm happy to be with them. The remainder I just kind of have in electronic format for now. And really, they come about just because, you know, I produce these essays over the years, and then I realize that they all have something in common, so I kind of put them together. And it, you know, it reads very much like a book. So that's how these things really happen.
One of them had intrigued me was the Heavenly Serbia and the medieval idea.
Yeah, well, that's something I put together back, I think that was in 2005. Mm-hmm. I discovered, I was at Fairleigh Dickinson University, and I had discovered some unpublished writings of some more distant members of the Kara Djordjevic royal family about the nature of medieval Serbia. And you know, it was essentially a libertarian, democratic nationalist state in the Middle Ages. I mean, you even had jury nullification. You had very, very advanced types of democratic government under a very firm nationalist monarchy. So it's something that even Orthodox people don't know about and Slavists don't know about. And from what I understand, it's selling very well. Mm-hmm. And there's much in the Balkans of value. Because these people are the inheritors of the ancient Greek philosophers and medicine and astronomers and scientists. Mm-hmm. I started putting a lot of that together, analysis of some of the epic poetry. There's a tremendous amount of symbolism, both Christian and secular, that really deserve our attention, and for the most part not getting our attention. But when I read about the Middle Ages, whether it be in the Balkans or in Russia or in Western Europe, generally speaking, I see a way of life that's very superior to how we live today. These people were generally healthy. If you eliminate the real problem that they had, which was infant mortality, if you eliminate that variable, they lived to a ripe old age, generally speaking. They were far more advanced than people realize in terms of medicine and architecture. And philosophy and logic and metaphysics and the rest of it, and they lived lives very, very simply, and it always struck me, even in reading about the Roman Empire or the Persian Empire, that you know these societies came into existence and became dominant over huge areas of territory, and never thought that our modern technocracy was ever necessary. And in the Roman Empire, the way that they farmed the land in the beginning of the empire was exactly how they farmed the land at the end of the empire. Mm-hmm. And it seems that stability was more important to them than what we call progress today.
That's interesting. All right. Good perspectives. Very fascinating discussions and history coming alive tonight on the program. Join us, ladies and gentlemen, with our guest, M. Raphael Johnson. I'm Rick Adams, Radio Avenger. We will return with more in just 3 minutes. And we're back now with our guest, M. Raphael Johnson, and Rick Adams is here to entertain and inform you tonight. But in any event, I want to continue, first off, Matt, discussing some of these issues about foreign events and foreign affairs. You know, foreign intrigue has been a term which has always been rather intriguing to me as a student, looking at how America now has become the empire of the world, as the Roman Empire did before it collapsed. And we have these neocons and these neoliberals, whichever, taking us down that path, one taking one path, the other taking another. But no matter where we've gone the last century or so, these powerful banking interests have used the country and our resources to meddle in the affairs of all of these other nations, creating for ourselves enemies. You know, I always get people to say, well, you know, you talk about World War II and how Japan never wanted to attack the United States. They wanted to attack Russia, and it was the United States that really provoked Japan. But look, we liberated Japan. We made them a democracy. And I laugh because I say, more democracy is not what the world needs. What it needs is more freedom and more throwing off the yoke of oppression from those who create democracy, which are the bankers and the criminals who profit from democratic leaders. In World War II, as you know, as a result of the war, Manchuria was raped, Korea was divided, the United States lost its face, and of course, Communist China was established. And how many tens of millions of people, was it 100 million maybe, that were lost to communism because of American imperialism and American interventionism?
I don't think that we're ever going to know the exact number of people who were imprisoned and tortured and murdered. The only thing that I was ever taught in school was that the only thing worth doing at that time was defeating Hitler, and then the world was okay after that.
yeah. It's still being promoted, isn't it?
It's still being promoted. One of the reasons I don't teach at a university anymore is that I was expected to promote that idea. I said, no, I'm a historian, I'm not a bureaucrat, I'm not a hack, you know, I'm not a careerist like you are. And, you know, to say that to a chairman of a department and to a dean of students is, you know, they don't take that very well. So, you know, my days in those institutions were always numbered. But I was expected to talk like this. I was expected to say that World War II was a great victory for peace and democracy. But when you bring up not merely the Soviet Union winning, the Soviet Union taking over Eastern Europe, Soviet Union then implanting itself in China, and then China itself implanting in places like Cambodia and parts of Africa, who knows the number? But, you know, talking like that will get you into a lot of trouble in the academic world.
Telling
the truth is a real problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these professors will talk about liberalism and openness, but they run their departments very much at an authoritarian scale. Most of their decisions are done in secret, including their attacks on me are always done in secret, never to my face. It's very par for the course. These people are aware that they're living a lie. But when you think of the gig that these guys have, where the average university salary is now $75,000, they only work a few hours a week, they get summers off, they get sabbatical years every few years where they could take off and do whatever they want. They have tenure where they can never get fired. You know, I mean, if you had that kind of a lifestyle, it would take a real superhuman will to try to break out of it and say, no, this is wrong. And I know, you know, when I was in grad school, I would go out with some of the professors afterwards. And after a couple of shots or after a couple of beers, these guys will say that we are living a lie here, that we are very, very coddled. And the only thing we really have to do in return is spout the line. And that this liberalism is something that we do because it's expected of us, and this is where the smart money is. You know, after a couple of beers, they start talking like this. So particularly the white males in academia, deep down, they know that they're liars. But when you think of the job that they have and the benefits that they have, it's difficult for these people to do much about it. So the academic world, I'm not in it anymore, thank God. I've been blacklisted, I think, from every university in America. explicitly and implicitly. So those days are over. But, who knows? Who knows what the future is going to bring? And I think that as this economy gets worse and worse, is that the U.S. gets more and more overextended abroad, and people can't pay their bills, hopefully some serious questioning is going to come from all of this.
Yes, and that is taking place somewhat now, as we see with warfare going on within the circles of power in the government of the United States, and some patriotic pro-Americanist generals and others in military perhaps talking, at least talking like statesmen, and about a timetable. We'll be right back with more of Matt Johnson, my guest.
Don't go away, because there's more on the Orthodox Medievalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. Return to the Orthodox Medievalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Here we are with M. Raphael Johnson, professor, and Matt, you just said something very interesting, that you are, I guess, banned. You are persona non grata in the so-called academic world, and I think you decided some time ago to just dismiss it all and do what you're doing now with your website and your, I guess you still lecture and you write and so forth. Is that pretty much what you're doing these days?
That is exactly what I'm doing these days. I mean, the money is about the same, and I'm feeling a lot better. I don't have to be in that environment. I've been told many times that you simply do not belong, and you will not fit in.
And now, you must have had a lot of students who appreciated what you were teaching, though, didn't you?
Well, I was the most popular professor everywhere that I've ever taught. I always had a following, whether I wanted one or not. Just to show yourself as something above the common herd of cattle is sufficient to get these young people. All of a sudden, they care about the Third Reich, or they care about North Korea, or they care about Burma, where before they got the same cliches over and over again. And you'd be surprised at how many students who usually show up to class with a hangover. All of a sudden, if someone starts really talking, stuff that no one else is saying, that you're going to get a lot of questions, and this is what began happening. Professors were saying to me, what are you doing that all of these students are talking about you? What are you saying in there? And then they began planting spies in my classroom. And then, Dean started having all of these typed out sheets of things that I say, and they say, how dare you step out of line like this? And I'm telling you guys that the university, the American university, is a miniature version of what the regime wants America to be like. The American university is a completely authoritarian environment. The university administrators control everything. They monitor your phones. They monitor your internet use. They of course, are completely in charge of feeding you, and yet at the same time, you can really behave, morally, in terms of alcohol and drugs, pretty much do whatever you want. So it's your perfect example of what they want the world to be. And of course, professors, if they toe the line, are completely insulated from any serious criticism. And if they have tenure, there's nothing you can do about them anyway. It's a complete and total police state in almost every respect.
Well, you know, that's true largely, but, you know, thank goodness we've seen some exceptions to that. Recently in California, one professor who had been singled out by the ADL because a couple of students went and complained to the administration and the ADL because he was criticizing the state of Israel, the state of Israeli, and, you know, this professor was threatened with removal, and yet he fought back, and in fact the university, the administration, decided that he was in the right and that they would stand by him. So there are some victories along the way, thank goodness, you know.
It's true, but you got to remember, as far as the Israeli stuff is concerned, you have a lot of non-white leftist movements throughout America who have always been treated very well by the system, who are, for the most part, anti-Israel. And so there is a certain degree of left-wing, almost, you know, neo-Marxist chic to being anti-Zionist. So that would be an issue, particularly when, you know, the Muslim issue comes up and things like that. Would be one issue where a university might pull back. Because generally, you know, in my experience, particularly black university students have a tendency to be somewhat hostile to Israel, and they view Israel sort of like a almost like a quasi European colonial power in the area, and so that's where you
reason,
have some leeway.
Yeah.
But no, exactly, yeah. And that's where you have some leeway. You know, I want to say that for the most part, I know this might sound eccentric, but my best students had a tendency to be black females. They were the most attentive, they were the most interesting, and a lot of the reason is that they're kind of raised in a way where they don't buy the establishment line. You know,
right.
You see it even with people like Cynthia McKinney and what's going on with her right now. That mentality runs very deep among black females, and I found them to be my closest allies, believe it or not, and I appreciate it.
That's very interesting. Needless to say, though, Condoleezza Rice was probably not one of them.
Not exactly, no. You know, and you get brought to that level of power, you can pretty much tell anyone what to do, and they'll do it.
It's interesting to see her transformation, too, where she would have been probably much more receptive in the academic world to the things people like we were saying. And then when you get to the, Washington, I hate to say apex, because that's not the apex, that's the bowel movement of government, I guess, is
right.
Washington. But when you get there, you either shape up or ship out, as you know. So let's take some calls here, Matt, for you, because we do have a few questions and comments from our audience. We're speaking with Matt Johnson here, and our first call is Les in Illinois, I believe. Hello there, Les.
Hi, Rick. This is Les. You know, we just met a few days ago.
Oh, yes, Les. Hi. How are you, Les?
Okay, I'm fine. You know,
good to meet you.
Documentary of my son.
Excellent.
I will have some question later, but I'd like to take advantage of Professor's presence and ask him some question. If you could elaborate a little bit on situation in Belarus. Because, you know, I'm a little familiar with the situation because, as you know,
I was going to ask that question, Belarus, but go ahead.
Yeah, I'm originally from Poland, and I know that the so-called Polish-speaking government is heavily involved in meddling in Belarus matters. Basically, they try and instigate some kind of revolution like they did in Ukraine. So, of course, you know, the President Lukashenko is demonized compared to Hitler. We see this pattern all over with other leaders, but he also tried to maintain independence from Russia, you know, so as we know. So maybe Professor could tell us more about the situation in Belarus.
Sure, go ahead, Matt.
Well, it's one of my areas of expertise. I have a book out on the topic as of right now. It's only in electronic form right now on my site as it stands. I've been talking about Lukashenko for a long time. He's one of my favorite international figures. He's an immensely talented leader. Lukashenko's claim to fame and his claim to popularity, he's still one of those if not the most popular political leader in Europe right now, is that he halted, in the 1990s, he halted privatization. He realized that in places like Russia and Ukraine and elsewhere that privatization was going to mob bosses and oligarchs who are shipping this money out of the country, and Lukashenko put a stop to it. He also threw the World Bank and the IMF out of Belarus, And this sort of thing got him very, very upset, you know, got him demonized, as Les said, got him demonized by the West. Since there's a lot of Poles in Western Belarus, Les is absolutely right. That minority in the Western part of the country has been mobilized to attempt to you know, do some damage to him. Lukashenko has tread very gingerly there. In fact, he's very close to the Polish, Roman Catholic bishops in that part of the country. He's, released public funds for the repair of their churches, et cetera, et cetera. So he's being very careful with that group of people, who make up, substantial part of the population in the far west of the country. But it's true that, that NATO and the EU have attempted to use the Poles, against them. The fact is that he's simply too popular. There's an unemployment rate of about 1%. The economy is going very well. The year-on-year growth is roughly between 8 and 9%. They're actually increasing in population, one of the few post-Soviet places that are, you know, increasing in the Slavic population rather than decreasing. And Belarus, and recently relations with Russia have turned very sour, and he is making certain that he is independent of pretty much everyone, and he has gone over the heads of the Russian government, has made regular deals now with Kazakhstan, with Iran, with Vietnam, and Burma. And you got to remember, the Belarusians are a highly educated people. They're deep into the technical fields. Their big specialty is oil refining and oil transportation. They also took care of a lot of the mechanization of the Soviet armed forces generations ago. So it's really one of the industrial hubs of the old Soviet Union. And Belarus is attempting, is really at the center of this non-aligned movement, and Lukashenko has spoken at these meetings on a regular basis, in building this counter-alliance against the New World Order. And he puts it in those terms with the countries that I just mentioned, and really whatever dissident movements exist out there, whether it be in Palestine or Venezuela, or even North Korea, and there's been assistance between Syria and Belarus as well, in oil, in gas, in mechanization, in computers, in all of these areas. So here you have this little country, the size of Kansas, that really has become the epicenter of the battle against the New World Order. So Lukashenko is an extraordinary figure. Les mentioned that they tried to overthrow him, like in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. He's absolutely right, but they failed miserably. They had a couple of hundred protesters in Minsk. The police kind of kicked them out of the way. It took about 10 minutes. That was about it. You don't really have a substantial opposition to Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus right now. And my view is, and I don't have tons of proof off the top of my head, but that the Poles in Western Belarus are relatively satisfied. The Belarusian economy is doing extremely well, and there's no reason for them to be upset or to be alienated, and Minsk has gone out of its way to accommodate them. So, I mean, I could go on about Belarus for about 4 hours, but I have the feeling that would be overkill. but I appreciate Les bringing that up. It's one of my big issues.
Yeah, does that answer your question somewhat, Les?
I just like to add, you know, maybe to explain to American listeners, you know, that there is some confusion, you know, because sometimes, you know, there's some statistics are being brought up showing, you know, like income level per capita, okay, which looks very low, okay. I like to explain, you know, that when I live in Poland during communist times, I make as engineer $30 a month, okay. So it looks like I was really starving, but it wasn't the case. I was able to support family, okay? So we have to be very careful when comparing this absolute numbers, because, you know, they are meaningless, okay? Because the situation and the exchange rate was completely different. For instance, when I was a student in Poland, I pay for dormitory $1 per month, okay? So maybe this is just wanted to add. So if we look at the income per capita, let's say that is few hundred dollars, whatever, doesn't mean that people in this country basically starve. Okay. So, and talking about the involvement of Polish government, they basically try to politicize Polish organization in Belarus, and they put different somebody, basically Angela Borys. She is not even Polish, you know, and they make a leader And this was against the will of the Poles living in Belarus, okay? So this definitely was the involvement of Mr. Soros and people like him. Okay, thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you, Les, for calling in, too. Appreciate your call. Say hello to Chris.
Les is absolutely correct about in terms of dollars and cents. That's why I like to talk in terms of percentages or increases or decreases. That makes the most sense. I mean, you could visit a doctor in China for something like 75 cents. That it doesn't exactly mean anything to Americans. It has to be compared in different terms. So he's right about that. Mm-hmm. And Les really sounds like one of us. Very much so.
Yes, he's a very good man. Let's talk to Art in Pennsylvania now. Hello there, Art. You're on board.
Thank you for taking my call, Rick. Here's a question for the professor. About 2 years ago, maybe several years ago, I was listening to public radio, USC School of Communications, and one day they announced, we don't need any more high-tech American workers. We got you replaced. So I found out it was advertised by the USC School of Communication in Market Watch, which is basically a front organization for the Annenberg Foundation. They were directly involved with Operation Mockingbird. I'm going to ask you what you see the role of Operation Mockingbird has to do with the propaganda that's being imposed upon the American people in colleges. And do you know anything about the Fox School of Business in Pennsylvania, run at Temple University, and looks like it's run by a major crime boss, just like Walter Annenberg was? Go.
Okay, first of all, I have no clue what Operation Mockingbird is. Second of all, I do know that universities are financed by these foundations, and you know, no academic research gets done without substantial funding. There's only a few major institutions that produce these grants, and they often have interlocking elite memberships. I'm pretty sure, and I'm willing to go to the mat on this, that it really is the institutions, the grant-making institutions, that have turned academia as radical as it is. That without particularly the Rockefeller, Ford, and Carnegie institutions, as well as a few major corporate grant-producing institutions, without them, I'm not sure that this that academia would be as bad today. Always keep in mind that these guys, coming from Western Europe in during World War II, the so-called Frankfurt School, every word that they typed up was financed by the Rockefeller Foundation. The beginning of Herbert Marcuse's book, every acknowledgement page says this book was made possible by the Rockefeller Foundation. But as far as Mockingbird is concerned, I'm sorry, I don't know what it is, unless I know of it under another name.
You might want to explain it to him, Art.
Operation Mockingbird was a joint CIA effort with Walter Annenberg and during what they call Radio Free Europe to basically take over the media of the United States. It's all over the web. You can read it real quick. And a big part of that was taking over the educational institution. Walter Annenberg was a big part of that. And he played a major role in taking over the propaganda machine that was imposed upon the American colleges. And to this day, it's not really been fully expressed how much damage they have done to independence of universities and actually looking at this. And it is directly related to what you're saying, to the funding. You know, try to get some funding without the Annenberg School Reform Institute having their 2 cents in what you're trying to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. I've come across that before, although I just, for some reason, don't remember the name Mockingbird. But I have come across several, you know, attempts to create a central command institution. Now, when I was at the American Free Press, I did. We'll talk about this later, Rick. I hear the music.
All right, okay. We do have a few seconds, but if you'd like to hang on, Art, you may. And Eddie, you stay right where you are, too. We'll continue with our guest, Professor Johnson, right here on the program, Rick Adams, Uncensored. Our listeners and our guest, Matt Johnson, with us. And we are talking with Art in Pennsylvania. Matt, you were about to respond to what Art had brought up. So go ahead. Tell us what you were going to say.
Well, it was actually something very similar to what he's alluding to. when I was at the American Free Press, I did a series of articles on Herb Allen, who at his ranch in Idaho every year has a meeting of all of the major figures in American media, a handful of major figures in academia, and usually one or two corporate sponsors. It's usually Starbucks. Sometimes it's Walmart, places like that. And he has all of these people together, and this is where they discuss what the big issues are going to be, what the big cultural icons are going to be, and what the big songs are going to be. He even tried to put out his own album not too long ago. So Herb Allen is one of these types that's kind of doing what Art is talking about, and you're creating some kind of central control over not just, you know, academics, but also all major media, including culture and music and television and everything else, and having one source and one place and one meeting or one set of meetings where these can be mapped out, at least in general terms. So the Herb Allen stuff was new to me. It doesn't get covered. There is no media attention on it other than the American Free Press. And I think that's something very close to what Art is talking about.
Is that like right, Art? Do you have any follow-up?
Well, I would say it's a little more detailed than that. Actually, I think our media was taken over during the Operation Mockingbird phase, which was during the 50s. And it was when they formed Radio Free Europe, and the CIA was basically, we're fighting against communism. And that was the era when we lost control of our media. And the person who did it, or the group that did it, was what I would call the Annenberg Foundation. They were powerful enough that after the Kennedy assassination, they handpicked Richard Nixon's cabinet, everybody, including Kissinger. And if you look at Walter Annenberg's father, Moses Annenberg, he worked with Capone. He was directly involved with going after newspapers in the Midwest and, you know, basically going into the operations and shooting them up, killing them. And that's the guy, that's the son of the guy who basically was then working with government to take over our media. That's how I see it.
Well, yeah, no doubt about it. Matt, a quick response and we'll move along. Go ahead.
Nothing. I have no problem with what he's saying. I think he's probably right. I think it's worth mentioning that the person who owns Voice of America right now is George Soros. And I think George Soros has a lineage behind him and that he's conscious about that.
Yes, very good point. Thank you for the call, Art. We appreciate that. You had some things you said you wanted to say about George Soros tonight as well, didn't you?
I didn't, but, you know, Les had mentioned Soros, that Soros is involved in trying to overthrow Lukashenko in Belarus, and that's very true.
Right.
He was deeply involved in the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. He was almost the sole sponsor of the Rose Revolution in Georgia. And even attempting to do it in Syria. His role in the Iran thing, I honestly don't know. I haven't heard anything, but I'm willing to bet my house.
I would be willing to do the same thing. You're right.
Yeah. So
can you stay with us into the second hour? We have another call or two that we have to get to.
I could give you a couple of minutes. I have full issues. Number one, I have little kids, and number two, my phone is dying.
I know. All right, if you could stay till 5 past the next hour, that would be great.
I could do that.
All right, we'll have you do that because I don't want to leave out a call here or two, and I'll do that. I'll continue to mention it because we have such little time together usually, and as you said, you could speak for hours just about some of these countries and some of these movements across the globe which appear to be moving in opposition to the New World Order. So these are important subjects, and we'll continue when we come back in 1 minute with Dr. Johnson, and I'm Rick Adams, your Radio Avenger. Stay with us. All right, we're back in the final 5 minutes of this interview with M. Raphael Johnson, our guest, and I want to take Eddie, a call from Eddie in Ohio right now. Hello, Eddie.
Hi, how you doing, Rick?
Fine.
Hey, I know he's got to go, so I want to make this real quick. I wonder if, being that he was in academia, can he answer this question? Do they have a problem hiring professors that speak English?
No. No, although I've heard that can be a problem in computer science.
Well, yeah, see, I'm sorry, that's just it. When I went to engineering school, there was nobody there that spoke English.
Oh, that's definitely the case. Information systems, computer science, I've heard that they're usually from India, Pakistan, sometimes the Middle East. Other fields, normally there's not a problem. But you're right, engineering, mathematics, I've had students say, I've been majoring in this for 2 years, I have never understood what my professor has said, not for 1 minute. So, you know, that's the case. And I don't know, I don't think it's affirmative action. I just think that these people are coming in with excellent resumes. Partially, I don't think it's affirmative action, partially because they're almost all male.
I had a class, true story. I walked in there, 21 people in the class. 19 people, okay, the students, they were from India. And the professor was from China. I was the only one there that was, quote, American, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally get it. And you know, I kind of avoided a lot of those classes when I was in college. I think the real reason you major in history is so you don't have to take a lot of mathematics and engineering style courses. But it's true. And the Asian populations are, I think, extremely talented in this regard. And this kind of, mental base is what they're building this new alliance on. An alliance, frankly, that I support. But I think in terms of, you know, being able to communicate in the language, this has been a problem. Now, I've also heard that they have a tendency to be the fairest of the professors. They kind of want to be liked, they want to be accepted, and they have a tendency to let things go that maybe a white professor, and certainly a white female professor, would not permit. So I've heard that, too. But because I'm not in these fields, I can't really discuss these at any kind of intimate level. But I have heard things like that, yeah.
Does that answer your question, Eddie, or do you have a follow-up yourself?
I just think that there should be some kind of a test where these people should speak English before they come in and start teaching anything.
I agree. I think it's crazy.
Actually, I had a comment in 1954 when Commander Perry, you know, broke open Japan. Mm-hmm. Did that cause the Japanese then to use this, quote, manifest destiny to, like, invade Korea and, you know, lead to World War II, you know? Real quickly, your feelings on that, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Sure. Thank you for the call.
That's actually a really good question. I'm not so sure that you could point to that as the cause. It certainly didn't hurt matters. Japan doesn't have any natural resources. Japan has a highly intelligent population. Japan is a very high IQ, collectively speaking, almost, you know, pretty much an equal with Europe. And so, you know, expansion for them was a way to build an economy. It's really kind of hard to condemn the Japanese expansionism when they're living in what essentially is a bunch of volcanic rock. And so expansion into Korea, into China, and then even, you know, later on down to places like the Philippines and Southeast Asia, this was almost a defensive move. If the Europeans are going to have these huge empires in Africa and Latin America and everywhere else, then we need to, being their equals, we need to have our own. And it was very difficult for me to be consistent in condemning this kind of expansionism when they were simply doing what everyone else was doing at the time.
All right. Well, thank you. Matt, I know I hear the music. I know that you have to leave, but I thank you for the precious moments we have from time to time. Hopefully we can do it again in August, okay?
Hey, no problem, Rick. Anytime, you know I'm here.
Thank you, and God bless your efforts. Okay. Thank you again, Matt Johnson.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Medievalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.